Hello everyone, welcome back. This is the general technology track at the ballroom C. A reminder, please use the microphone to address your questions to the speaker. And we need to stay on schedule so presentation will not be allowed to run over the time. This presentation will have 40 minutes, okay? And it's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker, Mr. Derek Atkins. He specialized in architecting, design, and deploying network system security applications. He is currently the Chief Technology Officer at SecureRF Corporation and was formerly a senior member of the technical staff at Mokana, senior principal software engineer at Symantec, senior research scientist at Telcordia, CTO at Arafa, and a member of the technical staff at Sun Microsystems. As a member of the IETF, Mr. Atkins was instrumental in the design and the standardization of OpenPGP and instant messaging protocols. He serves as chairman of the Open Web Authorization Working Group and serves on the IETF's Security Directorate. He formerly serves as chairman of the Cooperated Internet Negotiation of Keys Working Group. The Instant Messaging and Presence Protocol Working Group. And as a security glue on the IETF's Domain Name System Directory, Mr. Atkins earned his bachelor in electrical engineering and computer science, and his master's in media arts and science at MIT. Please join me in welcoming him to give a speech on the faster quantum resistance public key solutions for the constrained devices using group theoretic cryptography. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming back from lunch to hear me speak. I appreciate it. So I was going to get right into it and start talking about some real-world problems. We're all out here. We know that there's theoretical problems and there's real-world problems. So let's talk about the real-world problems. How do you secure a device that have minimal processing power and minimal energy capabilities? Seems like a straightforward question. Well, straightforward answer? Well, just use AES. It's out there. Almost every device has it. Sounds great. Problem is AES requires explicit key management. Whenever you have devices out there, you have to get the keys onto there. And if you have millions of devices, it just doesn't scale very well because you have to keep these databases of the keys out there. So the solution really is to use a public key algorithm. Great. We got plenty of those. Well, RSA, ECC, Diffie-Hellman, that's pretty much what's out there. But unfortunately, all of these require too much time, CPU, power on these very, very small devices. I'm talking about very small devices here. So the software implementations, if you can make them fit, are generally too slow, can taking seconds to do an operation, which if you're talking about booting up a missile, you can't spend seconds for the missile to boot up. Hardware implementations just take too much silicon and are still relatively slow. So what do? We need a lightweight solution, and that's where I'm going to bring to you some group theoretic cryptography as a solution for that. So what is group theoretic cryptography? This is kind of what I'm going to be talking about for the next 38 minutes or so. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of the background of GTC. I'm going to give you a math primer. So if you thought here you're coming here to learn to see pretty pictures, I apologize. This is going to be a math lesson for half the talk. And then I'll talk about two different public key methods that we've built on these technologies and a few conclusions. And also I got a demo, which I'll get to near the end. So group theory cryptography is not something that's actually new. There's even a book written about it. You can actually go to Amazon and get this book. It's been out for a few years now. Some of the hard problems in group theory cryptography have been studied for over 100 years. So again, it's not a new side of math. The interesting parts are that bringing group theory into cryptography is a little bit newer. That application actually dates back to the 70s. So people have been working on using group theory for cryptography as long as, you know, at the same time that, you know, Whit Diffie and Martin Hellman were doing their work, and Ravesh Shamir and Edelman were doing their work as well. So one of the interesting things about that we've discovered about GTC is that the computation complexity actually scales linearly with security. And I'll get to that a little more about what that actually implies and means. But compare this to the quadratic nature of RSA, ECC, and Diffie-Hellman. So let's keep in mind when we think about scaling. So let's actually break this down to what GTC really is. So every public method is actually based on some hard problem or hard set of hard problems. GTC is no different. So for example, RSA is based on the hard problem of factoring. ECC is based on the hard problem of discrete logs. GCC leverages structured groups, matrices, permutations, and arithmetic over finite fields. So a lot of this math that's happening is very similar to other things that are going on. So it's similar in those ways. So the difference here is that the structured group that we're using for GTC is the braid group. For anyone who has anyone with long hair in their life, you probably know what a braid is. And I'll get into more detail about that a little later. But I just want to point out that there have been other uses of braid groups for cryptography, and some of those have been broken. GTC is not any of those. Specifically, this is not braid group cryptography. So if you go and Google braids cryptography, most likely you'll come up with braid group cryptography, which this is not. That's some other stuff that has been done applying braids to cryptography in a not very effective way. So what is a braid? Braids were first introduced by ML Artin in 1921. And it's a configuration that kind of looks like this. You have a bunch of strands that you have a fixed point at the beginning, and then you twist them over and under each other until you get to the end. That's a braid. Like I said, if you have anyone with long hair, you probably know what a braid is. You probably built them yourself. So braids are interesting because they have a lot of mathematical properties that you get also from numbers. So you can concatenate them to yield a third. So you start with two braids, and you sort of smush them together, and you now have a new braid, which is the multiplication of the two. Braids also have the identity element. So in mathematics, you always have the identity element, and that anything times one is itself. Well, braids have the same concept, and that's it. It's a braid with no crossings. And it turns out if you put that braid with no crossings in either after or in front of any other braid, you get the same braid back. And it's not too surprising. So braids also have something called inverses. And again, this is the same mathematical concept that you'd have anywhere else. Anything times its inverse winds up being the identity. So you can have a braid. And basically the way you create a braid's inverse is that you flip it over and convert all the crossings. And if you smush those together, you would start being able to pull the braid pieces, the braid strands apart, and eventually you wind up having an identity element.
Question, is the number of strands fixed? I'm thinking you talk about identity, no crossings, but how many strands?
So that's a good question. So when you're talking, you can, and I'll get to that a little bit later, but basically you usually talk about the braid group on n strands, so bn. So n is a variable that you set when you start creating a static system. So right now we're talking about b4, so it's a braid on 4 strands. You can have a braid on 8 strands, 10 strands, 16, as many strands as you want. The identity element is still that number of strands with no crossings.
But when you compose two braids with n strands, you get a braid with 2 n strands.
So you always have here, I'm going to step off the podium for a second. So it's always 4 strands. So you have 4 strands that you combine. So it's always 4 strands. So once you fix n, you're always working with n strands. So you're never, you can't combine a braid with four strands with a braid with six. So you're, so.
Four equals four strands?
Four strands to four strands, because you're basically combining them together. So imagine putting your fingers together. You can't put your fingers together and then end up with eight fingers. You still have four to four. So it's, so the number of strands, you've basically fixed the number of strands. So these braids can be very, very complex when you add lots of crossings back and forth. One of the interesting things that MLRT did is he came up with this concept of generators. So you can consider each crossing to be a generator, and you can then build up any braid by concatenating these generators together. So for example, if we have n equals 4, so there's four strands, we have three generators. So you have B1, which is braid 1, this first strand crossing over the second. You have braid 2, B2, which is the second braid crossing over the third, and B3, which is the third crossing over the fourth. There's no B4 because there's no 5, there's not a fifth strand. So there's always n minus 1 generators for when you're working with BN. And of course, there's the inverses, which is just the opposite. Instead of, you can look at it either as instead of B1 cross, the first strand crossing over the second, you can think of it as the first strand crossing under the second, or you can think about it as the second strand crossing over the first. It's the same. It's the same. So again, there's three inverses as well. So one of the things you might have considered is that, well, if you can follow a braid from its beginning to its end, there's actually an associated permutation. So you have this braid here, and you can follow down. You can number each strand, the positions 1, 2, 3, and 4. And if you follow strand 1 from the beginning, it crosses over and back and winds up at space number 2. The second strand goes down, over, back, around, and comes up at space number 3. Associated 3 goes to 4, 4 goes to 1. So that's a permutation. Every braid has an associated permutation with it, but a permutation does not necessarily imply the braid itself. And you can picture that by looking at the double crossing at the end between 2 and 3. You can keep on crossing them back and forth, and the permutation keeps on switching back and forth. But just knowing that the permutation of 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 1 doesn't tell you how many crossings there were. So there's a lot of information that you don't get from just the permutation. So it hides a bunch of the structure of the braid itself. Now, one more concept I want to talk about is something called a pure braid. So you can find braids that are not the identity braids, but have the identity permutation. So identity permutation, 1 goes to 1, 2 goes to 2, 3 goes to 3, 4 goes to 4. Identity has that. You can find braids that don't. So here's an example of one. And if you follow the lines from left to right, instead of top to bottom, I apologize, you'll see that you always, for every strand, you wind up ending up exactly where you started. So this is called a pure braid, and they're interesting because they add structure without changing the permutation. So, okay, that's all well and good. We have these strands crossing. How the heck am I supposed to compute on this? I mean, computers don't understand this concept of braids. So now we have what's called a color bureau representation. And what this is this is a way to take the structure of a braid and actually turn it into something that you can actually compute on, which is a matrix. So every braid generator has, within BN, has an associated matrix and permutation with it. So the matrix is a color bureau matrix, or CB matrix, and we say sigma is the permutation. So we can basically iterate through all of the possibilities. So for example, for braid generator, you have an associated matrix. It's basically the identity matrix with one small non-identity entry in there, and the inverses are like that. These TIs are Laurent variables. So, yeah?
What kind of variables?
It's a Laurent variable. So it basically turns into a Laurent polynomial, which I'll get to in a second. So what happens is those variables are just there. They just exist as part of the structure of a color bureau matrix. And it just adds to the complexity of the structure of the braid. So you can imagine if you had a lot of these that get strung together, these TI variables wind up getting very complex into these elements. So I'll get to that. So I'll get to that right now. And in a second, we have what we have is the structure called this process called e-multiplication, which we denote with a star. And this is one of our core functions. So this is our one-way function as the building block for all of our technology, all the group theoretic cryptography that we're going to be talking about. So here's the system data that you need to do e-multiplication. First, you have to choose your n. So you're talking about a braid on how many strands. You have to have a finite field of q elements. So it could be a prime field or it could be a binary field. We tend to use binary fields, so a power of 2. And then you have what we call a set of t values. T values are elements within the finite field that you use to plug into those ti variables that were in that previous slide. And often there's a seed matrix as well that gets used, which is also an n by n matrix over the finite field. And I did tell you this could be a bunch of math. It gets worse. So basically, you can take e-multiplication by one generator is relatively straightforward. You start with some matrix and permutation, and it could be the identity, or it could be some random matrix, or it could be some matrix generated in some other way, or it could be the result of a previous e-multiplication. And then when you want to e-multiply by a single generator, that single generator implies a particular color Biron matrix and its permutation. And then you plug in the permuted t values. So you take the ti that you get for the ci this matrix, and then you find the ith t value permuted, and you plug it into the matrix. So now you have an identity matrix with three elements, tau sigma, basically the ti and t and inverse minus ti 1, and then just do a matrix multiplication, which computers can do. And then you can do this iteratively over the length of the braid to do a computation. So let me just do it again, because I know this is so a complex concept. Let me give you an actual number example. So let's say that we're working in B4, F7. So with that nomenclature, that means that B4 is a braid on 4 strands. So we're working with 4x4 matrices. F7 means we're working on a finite field of 7 elements. It's a prime field, and it's a number 0 through 6. We have 4 t values, which are all within that finite field, which are 2, 4, 6, and 3. And we start with this matrix and permutation, which I'm not going to read, but you can read it on the screen or in the slides. So now let's say we want to apply the braid generator B2. So we apply the current permutation, which is 2, 4, 3, 1, and we apply that to the CB matrix for B2. So there's a CB matrix for B2, looks like that. It's an identity, and then you have the T2 minus T2 and 1. So we apply the permutation to the t values. So you would say, so basically T2 would be the second. So we wind up getting, but because of the permutation, the second permutation is 4. So we wind up going to the fourth element in the t values, which is 3, which is why the T2 goes to 3. And the 4 is the fact that within F7, negative 3 is 4. And then we just now have these matrices, and we just do a standard matrix multiplication, and we wind up with this result. So you're asking about these TIs and why we're doing this. Well, here's a short entry of what happens if you leave those TIs in place. You basically get that. A TI is just a variable. So you have BI, so you have generators 1, 2, and 3. And when you're working with 4 strands, there's 3 generators, 1, 2, and 3. So you have 3 T value. You have 3 T variables, so T1, T2, and T3, because you have 1 associated with each strand, with each generator has this, and T4. So you actually have 4. So with each strand has an associated variable at every CB matrix. So that's what the TIs are. They're variables that get plugged in to basically do the structure of the braid. It's just an algebraic, you can think of it as an algebraic variable. So this is what it winds up being if you leave the variables in place. It gets very complex very quickly. And this is only 10 braid elements. Now imagine 1,000 braid elements. how complex this would get. So this is what E multiplications are erasing by plugging in those by plugging in the values originally. So like many other things, and I'm talking about hard problems, you know, in RSA, the hard problem is factoring. Well, there's a couple of hard problems in the break group as well. The first one is the shortest word problem. Basically, the idea is that the true length of a braid is the minimal number of crossings. But unfortunately, this is a known NP hard problem. So a single braid can have many different representations. So here's one braid. And you can see that if you look at the top of it, you can basically, you have a crossing and it's inverse. You can undo that. So now you have the same braid, but it has a different structure. And now if you look at the bottom right, there's another braid in its crossing which you can undo. So again, you can theoretically keep on doing this until you get to the shortest representation of a braid, but doing that is an NP hard problem.
I would have thought that you have 40 minutes, so you don't mind if I...
That go-
I don't want to take... You can tell me to...
Go ahead.
So I was thinking that the braid is defined by the crossings, but now you're saying that you can change the crossings and get the minimal braid. So how do you define the braid if it's not based on crossings?
Well, so a braid, a specific instance of a braid can be defined by crossings, but you can have equivalent braids. The equivalence relation is there are basically some braid relations. So you can which I can go into afterwards. But basically, you can have all three of these braids are the same braid, even though their crossings are different. So they are the same braid. You can see that because you basically took these braids that kind of have an inverse to itself. So if you look at the middle of the top one, you have a generator and its inverse next to each other, so they cancel each other out.
Because
they're consecutive. However, they don't have there's other relations that you can get where you can get two braids that transmute to each other. Okay. So there's another hard problem which is called the conjugacy search problem, which I'm just going to go through quickly. Basically, if you have a braid of this form where you have a braid word times another braid word times the inverse of the first part, we call that a conjugate. And if A is known, the problem is finding W. Unfortunately, this is a known easy problem. So in many cases, it's not very hard. There are algorithms that exist. However, the good news is that none of our technology is based on this. But the reason I bring it up is that we do have a hard problem that's related to this, which I'll talk about in a bit. So now that we've finished our math instruction for the day, let's start building up some cryptography with this. So we have many methods that are all based on e-multiplication. E-multiplication is the building block. You can consider it a brick, and you can use that brick to build a bridge. You can use it to build a house. You can use it to build a school. You can use it to build lots of different things. So it's that core constructive piece, and then it's a question of how you put that together. So we have what we call the Ironwood-Kiagruen protocol. It's a Kiagruen protocol where you have two endpoints that can communicate to each other and come up with a shared secret. We have a digital signature algorithm. We have another Kiagruen protocol, which works differently from the first one. We have a hash method where you can come up with a hash. But today I'm really going to focus on the first two, the Ironwood and the Walnut key agreement and signature schemes. So one thing about crypto, one of the interesting things about this is how we compare to some of these other technologies. So I mentioned before that our technology, that GTC scales linearly with time, with the security. So it's a Diffie-Hellman type key agreement. The signature scheme is DSA. But it's based on the infinite groups, linear time, and also it's interesting that it's known against quantum attacks, and I'll get to that much, much later. But if you look at the right, have the comparison. So as you add security to RSA and ECC, the amount of work that you have to do scales a lot. Whereas as you add security for us, it scales linearly. And the reason is that the complexity scales with the length of the braid. And the length of the braid is linear in terms of how you process it because e-multiplication is linear in the length of the braid. So yeah, if you have a braid that has 1,000 elements, you only have to do 1,000 E multiplications. And if you want to double the security, you wind up with a braid that's 2,000 in length, and you have to only do E multiplication 2,000 times. So that's why the work factor scales linearly with the length of the braid, and because of the structure of it, the length of the braid doubles with the amount of doubling security. So I'm going to quickly go through the Ironwood-Kiagrun protocol. There's a bunch of math here, which I'm going to go through quickly, just because of time. But again, we have some public system-wide information, which is your BN, number of strands, your finite field, and you have a matrix that's fixed. And then you have a trusted third party that does a lot of computation for you. So it creates a set of T values, which are those finite field elements that you plug in, and sets a bunch of conjugates. So we talked about the conjugate search problem. Because in this case, the values are not known, it doesn't apply. But I want to teach you at least what a conjugate was. So you have two sets of conjugates and that get created. So now we have two devices. We call home device and other device. And the interesting thing about Ironwood is that the amount of work done by the home device is more than the amount of work that the other device has to do. So it's an asymmetric system in terms of execution of the key agreement. So you can have a very low resource device and a less resource constrained device if you want. If both devices are the same level, then it doesn't really matter. But if you have one device that you know is of less capability, you can make that the other device. So on the more capable device, we have the home device. So it generates two matrices, which are polynomials of that seed matrix, and then generates two braids from its sets of conjugates with the same permutation. So you have beta and beta prime, which are two braids, and we talked about the permutations earlier, they just have to have the same permutation. And then you can then use the T values and do these two E multiplications. So you create a matrix and permutation from the first matrix and the first braid, matrix and permutation from the second matrix and second braid. And it turns out that both these permutations should be the same. So then you can compute your public key by combining those two together in this form. So what does it all mean? Well, you have your C and C prime, your private matrices, so it's part of your private data. They're fixed in size based upon N and Q. They need to be kept secure, obviously, because they're private data. You also have your two private braids, beta and beta prime, which are variable in size. And that's just the structure of braids. Braids, because you can do these manipulations, are not fixed size, so you need to be able to deal with variability there. But they also need to be kept secure because they're part of your private data. And the public key is also a matrix, same size as C and C prime, because it's based on the same N and Q. And that gets shared with your other devices. And you can also encode into a certificate if you wish to verify the identity of the home device. Also, it needs the T values, and that needs to be, again, remain secure. So now we have the other device. And these devices are a little bit more challenging. You basically generate a non-singular matrix in a similar form, and generate a random braid word using the other set of conjugates, and compute the public key using that E multiplication. And just one thing I want to point out, this operation is happening on the trusted third party, and the results get provisioned onto the other device. So one thing you'll notice is that this device doesn't need access to the T values. All it takes is that matrix and the public key. So again, what does it have? You have your private matrix, again, fixed in size, kept secure. It's the same size as all the other matrices because, again, N and Q are fixed. The public key is a matrix plus a permutation, and that gets shared, and again, it can be assigned by a CA into a certificate to identify the other device. So how do you use this? Well, it works like any other Diffie-Hellman. Once you get to this point and everything's provisioned, it works like any other Diffie-Hellman style scheme. You exchange your public keys. The home device then computes two E multiplications. And then computes two column vectors from those matrices and sends one of the column vectors to the other device. And then the other device can then compute the other column vector via matrix multiplication and vector math. So at this point, both devices have S prime, which is a shared secret, and then you can then use that to authenticate or plug into AES or some other method. So what does it mean? Again, like I said, the devices share their public keys, certificates can be validated, and then looks like that. So it's basically it's a key agreement scheme, and the only difference between that and something you'd get from ECC or Diffie-Hellman in terms of usage is that both devices have to be provisioned securely. And then once they're provisioned, they can go out into the field and then can communicate without going back to any database, without going back to any server, and without having to have a secure storage of key material other than its own private key. So the other thing I want to talk about quickly is the Walnut Digital Signature algorithm. So this is a quantum-resistant public key signature scheme. It's, again, based on our group theory of cryptography, again, leverages e-multiplication for very, very fast signature verification. And the security is based on a couple of hard problems, and the break group and reversing e-multiplication. So the architecture is very similar to, looks. If you look at this, you say, oh, that looks like every other signature scheme I've ever seen. DSA or ECDSA look just like this, where you take a message, hash it, sign it with the private key into a signature, take that same message into a hash with the public key and the signature into the verification, and you get a yes-no response. So unlike the Ironwood, where you have this trusted third party, Walnut is purely on its own. There's no trusted third party at all. So the only thing you have to agree upon ahead of time is choosing your N and Q. So we're suggesting B8F32 for a 2 to 128 security level. So that means a B8 braid on 8 strands. F32 is a field with 32 elements, or 2 to the 5. So it's a 5-bit field. So then you generate random T values within that finite field, where none of them are 0 or 1. And then you choose exactly 2 T values to be 1. And then you choose a private braid. Your private key is a random braid of this length. And I can explain what that means later. But basically, that's how long you have to have the braid be for it to give you, 2 to the 128 possible choices, at a minimum of 128 choices. And then you compute your private key by using the T values and E multiplication. And you have to distribute your public key, which is the T values, the matrix, and the permutation of your private key. So that's it. Did everything by yourself. So signature generation. So let's take, we're assuming that we're already doing a hash. So the hash is allied in all these slides. So you can choose to use SHA-256, which is what we're doing. You can even use the hash based on e-multiplication that I talked about. The hash is kind of orthogonal to the method. But the idea is that you take a 256-bit message, which is the output of a hash, and we encode that as a braid. And I'll explain that a little bit in a bit. But basically, we have a way that you can take any message and you can get a unique braid out of it. And then you choose a random number from 1 to n, and we generate what we call a cloaking element. And again, I'll get to what a cloaking element is, but it's basically a pure braid that disappears under e-multiplication but adds to complexity. And basically, it's built by conjugating a square of a braid generator. So you basically, the I that you chose means you have a BI, which is that one, and you square that, and then you generate a conjugate like this, where the permutation of your braids are special based upon the I and your choices of A and B for your T values, which are 1. So the purpose of these cloaking elements is to obscure the private key from the conjugate search problem. So I mentioned earlier, conjugate search problem is an easy problem if you know the middle. Well, in this case, you no longer know the middle, so it makes that problem hard. As your cloaking elements become trivial, then it reduces back to the CSP. And basically, your signature then is this braid of this form. So you take the inverse of your private key, your first cloaking element, the encoding of the message, your private key, non-inverted, and then the second cloaking element, and then you rewrite that to obscure it. So I mentioned earlier, I showed earlier how you can take a braid and you can change the paces. There's other ways you can rewrite a braid, and you result in something that has the same structure but looks completely different. So that's what you're doing here to hide the structure of this braid. And that's your signature. So a little more on the cloaking elements. Cloaking elements are really cool if you're a group theorist. So as if you recall, the search problem requires a braid of that form, of Z, A, Z inverse. So a cloaking element is just a special braid. It disappears during E multiplication, which I'll show in a second. And it prevents the CSP from working because it's no longer of that form. And as I showed, it works it's of this form. But here's the interesting result, is that when you take an input, and actually it doesn't have to even be 1.1, 1, it could be 1, any particular permutation. And when you E multiply by your cloaking element, you wind up with that same starting matrix and permutation. So any matrix so you have a cloaking element that's designed for a specific permutation, and you can start with any matrix with that permutation times that cloaking element, and you get the original result out. So it disappears when you E multiply. But if you look at the braid itself, it actually has structure. So that's what's interesting about cloaking elements. So as I said, you can, based on the actual form choices, you can actually have any kind of matrix in any permutation here. So this is one of our novel ideas. It's relatively new in the literature at this point, but we are encouraging more analysis on this. So signature validation is where Walnut really shines. So the concept is very similar. It starts the same way. You take that same 256-bit message, which will be your message output, the output from a hash. Use the same encoder, so you get the same input, the same middle part of the signature. And then you do two e-multiplications. The first e-multiplication you do is the identity stop e-multiplied with that braid. And then you take the matrix part of that and do a matrix multiplication times the public key. And the second e-multiplication you do is the public key and e-multiply with the signature. And again, you get another matrix and permutation from that. And then the question is matrix 1 equal to matrix 2? And if they're equal, then the signature validates. And if they're not equal, then the signature does not. Then the signature validation failed. So one thing I want to point out to you, this is very structurally similar to DSA and ECDSA versus RSA, because you get a yes-no at the end. You don't get the input back out like you would with RSA. There's no TCP required like there was with Ironwood. There's no public conjugates. There's no system-wide data at all other than N and Q. And you can even transmit N and Q with the public key so that you can have verifiers can do different things. So performance is one of the things that's very, very interesting for Walnut. So we actually implemented it in both hardware and software on different platforms. MSP430, which is the top line, is a 16-bit platform. The 8051 is an 8-bit platform. And ARM Cortex-M3, obviously, is 32 bits. And then we have also done FPGA. And we compared it to some literature searches that we found for some ECC. And one thing you'll notice is that in places where we could actually find ECC implementations, we couldn't even find one for an 8051. It just doesn't fit. For P2256, the best we could find on an 8051 was, I think, a 160 or 163. They didn't do anything bigger than that, because, who would ever use that? So we don't have that. That's why the matrix is not completely filled in. But one thing you'll notice is that in terms of our code space, we are half the size on the ARM and 1/10 the size on the MSP. And in terms of our RAM usage, again, we're half the size on the ARM. We are 1/10 the size on the MSP. But look at the time. And this is where we're really shining. We're basically 40 times faster than ECDSA verification. Even on the FPGA implementation in hardware, where we can do a signature validation in 50 microseconds versus 200 versus 2 milliseconds. So again, 40 times faster. So quantum, Basically, National Security Agency is advising U.S. agencies and businesses to prepare for a time in the not-too-distant future when all the cryptography protecting virtually all email, medical, and financial records and online transactions is rendered obsolete by quantum computing. This is a statement made back in 2015. I'm sure many people all know this already. These methods are immune to quantum attacks, and let me talk a little bit about why we say this. Generally, there's two important quantum methods that are being used to attack existing technologies, which is Shor and Grover. So Shor is going to break ECC, RSA, and Diffie-Hellman, and the reason is that it can quickly factor or solve discrete logs. But really what it's doing is it's solving what's called the hidden subgroup problem. For that to work, the method's math needs to be finite, cyclic, and commutative. So finite needs to be a limited size. Cyclic means once you enumerate all the possibilities, it then starts doing it over again in the same order. Commutative means that A times B equals B times A, so 5 times 3 equals 3 times 5. This technology is neither cyclic nor commutative. As I showed you earlier, the braids are can be multiplied, but A times B does not necessarily equal B times A unless you construct it to work that way. So in general, it's not commutative. It's also not cyclic. So you can eventually enumerate all the potential contents in the matrix, but once you do that, you don't get back to where you started again, and it doesn't continue in the same order. So two of the three requirements for the hidden subgroup problem don't apply, therefore Shor does not apply. Grover's search algorithm just takes your security level down in half. It basically affects pretty much everything. This is actually why AES-256 exists, to get you back to 128-bit security level. The way we get around Grover is just because we scale linearly. So you just double the size and you double the amount of work, and we get back to where we were. Okay. So some of the commercial use cases that we found would be anti-counterfeiting solutions. For example, we've got an industrial partner that's using this technology to protect some replacement parts that were being counterfeited. So we have small chips on both sides that can authenticate each other using this technology very quickly. So you can get authentication in 100 milliseconds or less, depending on what's being done. We've built a credentialing system, so you can do a faster quantum resistant replacement for a CAC card, for example, working with a DoD partner to store some secure data on that as well. We've worked with a quantum resistant secure boot solution. So for example, on the RISC-V processor, you can validate its firmware before it runs. You can even do mutual authentication of IoT devices. You can basically prove your identity without going back to any kind of databases. So I want to quickly give a demonstration, assuming I can get it to work pretty quickly. So unfortunately, the length of the screen is a little too big for this. So what I have here connected is an FPGA that has our Ironwood agreement and ECC as two hardware cores. So they're running side by side. And what I'm going to do when I start this is it's going to paint two pictures. On the left is going to be from the Ironwood, and from the right is going to be ECC. Basically, every line is going to be an authentication. So every time it completes an Ironwood authentication, it'll draw a line on the left. Every time it does an ECDH operation, it will draw a line on the right to give you a relative view of the speed. So I'm going to start this, and I'm going to ask you not to blink, and I'll scroll back up as soon as I start it. There we go. Did you miss it? Do you want me to do it again? All right. So we can go sit here for the next 2.5 minutes while it completes the 512 authentications, which it did in about, 72 milliseconds for Ironwood. Okay. So basically, this is a microfusion to smart by Microsemi. So that's some information about the demonstration. So conclusion, since I know I'm running out of time, I just want to say that we've got some public key solutions. We think it's suitable for IoT devices. It's significantly faster than RSA, ECC, and Diffie-Hellman. Performance will scale linearly. And the core technology can be made to do lots of different things. And quantum resistant. And has a small footprint. So we think it has a big future in IoT. Thank you.
Do you have any patents granted or pending?
Yes, we do have patents, both granted and pending. However, we want this technology to be used, so licensing is reasonable. And even though we have patents granted, we also believe in open literature. So all of our technology has been published, or at least made the math is publicly available because we want public review. So even though it's patented, we do want. You know, we want to be open about it, so it's not security through obscurity. But we can talk, if you're interested in licensing, we can talk about that.
Hi, thanks, Derek. So Shor's algorithm extends to finitely generated groups as well, and it's been extended to some non-abelian groups as well. Have you looked at those extensions?
See
if they would apply here.
We have actually spoken to Peter.
Yeah,
and Peter basically said, "I have no idea how I'd apply this to your technology."
Okay.
So, take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, but you haven't looked at all the various.
I personally have not.
There's nilpotent and solvable. I mean, the chance of it applying, I guess, is it?
The chances are very low.
Necessarily high, but
yeah, okay. the chance of it applying are very, very low. Like I said, Peter doesn't think it would apply. I haven't specifically looked at it. I can go ask our mathematicians if they have. I suspect they have.
Okay, thanks.
But I don't know off the top of my head, but I can get you the answer if you want to come up afterwards and give
sure.
me your info.
That'd be great.
All right. If you have questions, I'll be in the audience. You can come ask. You can talk to me now.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's yours? Yes, very good. Okay.